This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. Today, episode 6, Man-Eating Monster to Flower-Toting Belle, the transition of fairies in the Victorian era.
So we're finally doing it.
After weeks of slipping the little winged demons in every chance you got.
Jules has finally allowed us to have an episode about fairies. My time has come.
Right, well, I think you should probably take the lead on this one, but I'm going to start off by asking you a question because there's a fundamental difference in the way it's spelt, isn't it, between fairies and fairies, as in F-A-I-R and F-A-E-R.
That's right. Well, when did the thing is, there's no direct rule between them, and lots of people will interchange the spellings as they see fit. For me, for my research, I decided that there needed to be a distinction. Now, if we go to the F-A-E-R-Y or I-E spelling, that was originally conned in reference to a supernatural creature rather than a place by Edmund Spenser for his The Fairy Queen. So that was the first time in written history that we had the word fairy being used to describe the supernatural beings, because previous to that, fairy was the place where the supernatural creatures resided. So that was our first written usage of that word in that context. And Edmund Spenser's fairies covered a very wide variety. So it included things like banshees, it included red caps, it included certain goblins. It covered a lot of areas. So it was very much an umbrella term. Later on, mainly in the Victorian period, because of the fairy tale, the word fairy was modernized into F-A-I-R-Y. And that became synonymous with a particular image that we have. So nowadays, most of the time when I say fairy, or I write fairy, F-A-I-R-Y, people get an image of Tinkerbell. They see flower fairies. They see a very specific diminutive image of what a fairy is. And so that spelling, in my mind, is very particular to that kind of fairy, of which there were some in mythology. But when I say F-A-I-R-Y, would you immediately think about a Kelpie, for instance? Kelpies were water horses. They would trick people onto their backs and dive into the water and, you know, eat their liver and stuff. It was very unpleasant. And those two things don't mix. So I divided the spellings because I wanted to use the old spelling as the umbrella term for all of these supernatural creatures, and the word fairy, A-I, to describe what occurred, the supernatural creatures which existed pretty much in Victorian folklore, of Victorian literature, and which has become our image of fairies today.
They're sort of cute, Disneyfied.
Yeah. So we've got Tinkerbell, man-eating monster, and that's what our episode is about today. How did this happen? So we've got a few books to talk about, and we're being a little bit cheeky, because we're not just sticking in the Victorian era. We are going to sort of look a little bit before and after. And I feel that If we're going sort of periodically, it would be prudent for us to talk a little bit about Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Yeah, by Susanna Clarke. You might have caught the recent television adaptation, which was good, but not a patch on the book.
Now, see, this is going to be good because I've only seen the TV version, but you've read the book.
I've read the book twice now, and actually, the second time I finished reading it, I wanted to just go back to the start and start again, because it is just such a fabulous, all-immersive world. But it's very much a case of, if, for those of you who haven't read it, it's all the magic in England seems to have gone, and there only appear to be academic magicians who sit around and have nice suppers and drink wine and talk about magic, and it's really not the done thing to actually practice magic physically and do actual magic, except you have Mr. Norrell, who has learned how to practice magic properly. He spent years of studying it, out of nowhere, Jonathan Strange, who's, he's not really a dandy as such, but he's certainly a bit on the lazy side.
He's veering towards that.
Sort of gentleman's son, really doesn't have an occupation of any kind. And the girl he wants to marry refuses to marry him until he has some sort of occupation and makes himself useful, just because she feels he needs a focus in his life. And it turns out he's very good at magic, just naturally.
Instinctual.
And it later on you realise there's a prophecy about two magicians will return magic to England, because all magic comes from the Raven King. And the Raven King was a child. He was a changeling, and he was born in England in the 1600s and brought up as a slave in Faerie, essentially. And it goes on from there.
I mean, it's set during the Regency period, and it's very interesting because Clark, isn't it? Susanna Clark.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Clark created a sub-history within the world, which means that whilst it feels very much like our own history, there's this kind of sub-folklore going on too, which is very interesting, the way she fits them together. And certainly the way she described academic magicians is very in keeping with what was happening in the Victorian period and previous to that, where there were spiritualist sort of associations who did a similar sort of thing, and they couldn't really practice magic, but they studied it. And I was totally enchanted by the series, and I do have to read the book. And I think it was very telling of the period and our actual attitudes toward magic during a time in history where people believed in magic from the past but didn't think that it was applicable to the present.
I think that was the thing, wasn't it? The late Victorian era particularly was becoming the Age of Reason, or at least the Second Age of Reason. And scientific method was being applied to everything. And so while you still had things like the old fairy stories and fireside tales that were told, they were considered to have happened, 100 years or so ago.
They were the tales of old England. I've mentioned this before. My PhD, basically, is on the definition of fairies and how fairies were defined during the Victorian era. But my focus is on how they were defined in different parts of the British Isles. Because everyone says, oh, the Victorians evolved the fairies. The fairies evolved during the Victorian period. And I don't think that that's quite true. I think that a new kind of fairies, that the definition of fairy changed in some parts of the British Isles, namely in urban cities, but that it remained very much the same in other parts. Now, I think we should discuss in particular, having looked very briefly at Jonathan Strange and some of those themes, we should discuss what it was about the Victorian period that suddenly got everybody interested in magic again. And I think the interesting thing is that there is an element of Jonathan Strange and Dr. Norrell? Mr. Norrell. I'm mixing up books here. I'm thinking of Jacqueline Hyde.
Well, that would be a completely different fairy tale.
That would be a great crossover, Jonathan Strange and Dr. Jackal. Completely different story. What was I saying? Evolution. And the reason that fairies became so popular during the Victorian period, a lot of academics agree, was because of the rapid development of what was happening. Rapid industrialism, capitalism, as England basically stretched its control over pretty much the entire world. I mean, we were doing pretty well as far as empires went. I mean, we were doing horrific, terrible, terrible things. But we had control over a vast amount of the world. We circled it.
We were the empire on which the sun never set. It was always rising on some part of the empire.
Yeah. And what happened was that in the urban parts of Victorian England, in London, I'm just going to say London for the moment. It was happening in other places, but we'll focus on London. In London, there was London, because London was the capital of England and therefore was the capital of the empire. It was the centre. So there were a lot of different people there. There was a lot of Chinese people there. There were a lot of Indian people there. There was a lot of traffic because this was the centre of the empire. So this is why I always laugh whenever they do sort of They do period dramas set in London and everybody's white, and I'm like, excuse me.
Yeah. It wasn't like that in
It was
Saxon England, so it certainly wasn't
definitely
like that in the Victorian era.
it was a joke in Psych, where at one point they're like they were staging a Ripper play, and one of the black actor was there like, oh yeah, I'd like to play this part, and they're like, sorry, this is set in 19th century England, and he looks at the director and goes, what are you saying, black people weren't invented then? And I always really like that line because it was true, because Victorian London was definitely wasn't exclusively white. In fact, it was not very white at all. There was a lot of different cultures and a lot of different people happening there, and that remains to this day. So it's a very multicultural city. So there was a lot of this happening, and English people kind of had a crisis where they felt that their heritage, their culture was slipping away, and they basically got scared. So they started to look back on who they were, as who we are as an island, you know, who the British are. And I always laugh because what they did was that they decided that fairies were exclusively British, which is really funny, because the fairies that appeared in Britain were an amalgamation of Slavic, Nordic, and Celtic folklore. So the fairies are definitely, absolutely not. Not exclusively British. In fact, in trying to create something which was exclusively British, the Victorians stole something from a bunch of other cultures and claimed it as their own. So I guess in that case, they did create something which was British, because if the British are good at anything, it's definitely stealing other people's stuff. If you've ever been to the British Museum, you can account for that. If it was full of stuff that was only British, it would be very, very empty. We're pillagers by nature. So they pillaged all of these ideas, put them together, and said, ta-da! This is a fairy, it's British. And that is where the fairy came from, because they wanted something claim as their own.
Why exactly choose what essentially is a nature spirit, though? You know, a small female with sort of dragonfly wings sitting on a toadstool.
I think, again, that was because of industrialism. There were these cities rising up, there was smoke billowing out of these huge chimneys. There was all the stuff happening, and people wanted to connect with the earth again. They wanted to connect with the environment. And there was also something else that was happening during the Victorian period, and that was, as well as folklore, folklorists, which is where it came from. They started out really in the Victorian period. There were environmental studies happening. People were very interested in the environment. They were very interested in nature. We had Darwin thundering around the corner during the Victorian period and changed everything. And there was a lot of stuff happening in that area. So it doesn't surprise me in the least that people connected the two things. And interestingly enough, because previous to this, a lot of Victorians were comparative folklorists, and they believed that the fairies were the remnants of the old pagan gods, which that stands to reason. That's probably a pretty good assessment of where fairies came from. They were nature spirits, remnants of Neolithic ancestral worship. And that's an interesting thing, that across the world, fairies tend to have a distinct similarity, which is that the entrance to fairyland is almost always a burial ground, an old burial ground of some description. And that goes from, you know, Kilimanjaro to the fairy, the Shee Mounds in Ireland.
Yeah.
What was I saying? I got distracted.
we were talking about the need for the connection between nature, especially at that
That
time
was it.
because
That
of
was
the
it.
Industrial Revolution.
That's where they thought fairies came from. And then when Darwin came around, people began to actually wonder whether fairies evolved from an actual pygmy race of people who existed in the world. And there was all sorts of things, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Cottingley fairies later on. But Gardner, who was one of the big advocates for the Cottingley fairies and their validity, made note to his sister at one point, and this was recorded in a letter, that the fairies seem to have a similar evolution as insects. So they combined science and spiritualism, in that they wanted desperately to believe in something magical. And then, in order to believe in something magical without being laughed at, they needed to apply science to it. So it was very contradictory.
Like many things in the Victorian era.
Like many things in the Victorian era.
Because I was just thinking, as you said that, the need for reconnection with nature. You also had the Luddite uprisings in the early Victorian era as well, where people were protesting because machines were coming in and effectively taking their jobs away in mills and factories where everything had been done by hand before. Now it was cheaper and more cost effective and produced higher yields if they had machines in to do it. So people were losing their jobs. So very much as they had in France, where you had the saboteurs who were throwing wooden clogs in the machines.
Yeah.
You had people over here, and it got quite violent as well.
It did, but that's because they were building this entire empire, and they had all these machines, and it was progressing so rapidly that they didn't actually think about what they were going to do with these workers once they, you know, once they'd installed these machines. It's not that they had something else for the workers then to do. They had a surplus of people with whom they knew nothing about, and because they'd created such a huge divide in classes, there were all these poor people, these working class people, who had literally nowhere to go because education, you know, wasn't really a thing that they did, and because there was still this huge divide in class. And I think that's really where the problem lay.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, fairies was definitely something which was applied to class. And, you know, we talk about rural and urban, the differences between fairies and rural and urban areas. But it was definitely something as well in class, which is that fairies, F-A-I-R-Y, were very much the indulgence of the middle and upper class. They were pretty, they were an illusion, they were a merchandise which could be bought. And that was specifically apparent in the fairy pantomimes. Pantomimes were a huge thing, and they would have these fairies, and what would happen is that rich families would go and see these pantomimes, and they'd see these beautiful glittering illusions of these young children dressed as fairies. And it was totally contrary, because they would look at these and think, oh, how wonderful, this is so full of wonder, and it was lovely, and it was a tale of an illusion. And of course what was happening was that these children who were in the pantomimes were wearing very thin, tiny clothes. They were working class children. Some of them were very young. They had to sit incredibly still. It was extremely cold. And at the end of the day, they would then have to try and make it home very, very late at night. So the fairies also came around because of this weird morality that Victorians suddenly developed about children and not wanting children to grow up too fast. And they loved the image of the fairy because the fairy was this immortal, immortal innocence of a child. And yet in creating the image of the fairy, they were basically taking away the youths of these children who were being forced to work for money in terrible conditions.
Many of whom probably didn't live to adulthood.
No. But hey, it's the Victorian era. What can you do about it?
It was the Victorian era.
So I feel that we should talk about the Cottingley fairies. And then we should talk about Peter Pan. Peter Pan and the Cottingley fairies. Oddly enough, the image of the Cottingley fairies is very much how we envisage Tinkerbell.
Yes. I mean, obviously, Peter Pan came first.
Yep, Peter Pan did come first.
And was the creation of J.M. Barrie. And you've just mentioned the pantomimes, and obviously it was adapted for stage, and it was very successful, and it still runs now, I think.
Indeed, except, of course, that the Tinkerbell was never played by a child.
No.
In the pantomime, she was always a tiny light. You never actually saw her. Have any lines?
I think she still is a tiny light. I think I might have seen the pantomime. I'm pretty sure it is still a tiny light.
I like that. I like the way they did that. It was very clever. But interestingly enough, Barrie was Scottish, and he actually was drawing on a lot of the folklore that he grew up with, as well as the environment in which he was, where he was living. And so the way he created Tinkerbell, the way Tinkerbell looked, was very much a reflection of how fairies looked in fairy paintings of the era. And yet, the mythos behind Tinkerbell, who she is and what she's up to, is very much not what the image was in Victorian England of the fairy. She's very much an old fairy in her character and a new fairy in her looks, which is quite interesting.
As in, quite capricious, and you didn't want to get on the wrong side of her.
You didn't. She could only feel one emotion at one given time, because her body was so small, apparently, she could only feel one thing. She tries to kill Wendy.
On several occasions.
She's very jealous, she's very possessive. She kidnapped Peter as a child.
As fairies do.
As fairies do. So these are all things which were very much in keeping with fairies mythology, and especially found in Scotland and in Wales and Cornwall and Ireland. Basically everywhere in the British Isles except for Britain. Though in the north of Britain as well. Yeah, we're just going to talk about the south of Britain, London.
Where they had leisure and probably money and enough food.
Yeah.
And a slightly slower way of life to sit and think about these things and pretty them up a bit.
Basically, yeah. But the way she looked, the way she's described, is very much in keeping. And I wonder whether Barry wasn't actually doing that knowingly. I don't think it was unconscious. I think he was kind of mocking people's perception. Because Wendy's, they're like, oh, isn't she darling? And then Tinkerbell's like, ah, ha, 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 and tries to kill her. So I wonder whether he wasn't actually implying that fairies have changed because they now have easier targets, you know, like how predators will sort of do certain things which attract their prey toward them.
Like the anglerfish.
Yeah, like the anglerfish. It's the same with fairies. Fairies have made themselves all nice and sweet looking according to what we want to see, but their characters haven't changed in the least. So, Cottingley fairies.
So, brief recap for anyone who didn't happen to stumble across last week's podcast. No, actually, it was 2 weeks ago. Do you want me to recap? I was thinking, well, this is your area of expertise. I'll talk about
the Cottingley fairies. The Cottingley fairies weren't actually the Victorian era. They were set just afterwards. It was 1920, I believe.
I think the first picture was 1916.
It was
over about sort of 8 years.
Yeah. And what happened was that cousins, Elsie Wright and Frances Griffith?
Yeah.
Griffiths, I think, both beguiled the world by taking pictures that apparently had fairies in them. Now, if we look at those pictures, we can obviously see that they're fake. But at the time, they really had a huge impact because they were picked up by Conan Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes, who had already publicized several papers about fairies. He was a strong spiritualist, especially after he lost his son in the war, and he got very much into spiritualism even more after that. And so he wrote several papers about fairies, and he picked up these fairy pictures, and you can look them up, the Cottingley fairies, on Google. You can see several of the pictures, and he published a paper about them and then a subsequent book. And there was a very mixed reception. On the one side, some people really did believe that these were actual fairies. On the other side, there was a lot of skepticism. And now we can look at them, we can see that they're very obviously fake. And we wonder how it is that anyone of any intelligent mind could have been fooled by these photos. But we must consider the time. And someone made an excellent point in one of the articles that I was reading for my paper, that the camera was a scientific piece of equipment during the time. And so the things that came out of the camera, photographs, were considered to be factual. Because fraud, in that sense, wasn't a thing that was happening. It wasn't popular yet. It started to happen a little bit, during the time, a little bit later. But right at the beginning, the camera was a scientific piece of equipment. The other thing is that the microscope was relatively new at the time, and the discovery of disease and how it worked and things that the human eye couldn't see but could be seen through technology was really hitting it off with the Victorians. They were very excited by this. So when we consider that they had just discovered that there were things in the world which couldn't be seen by the naked eye, but through technology could be seen, it's not that far-fetched for someone to say, look, I took this scientific piece of equipment and I photographed fairies which were having a huge comeback during the time, and there was a lot of scientific sort of research into them. It's not that far-fetched for someone to say, and here, I have produced something from it. So that was the Cottingley fairy photographs. And much later on, after Conan Doyle died, and he died believing that the fairies were real, both cousins came forward and admitted that four of the photographs were fake, but they both maintained that the fifth one was real to their deaths. They maintained that.
The other thing was that Elsie admitted that she'd never seen any fairies there, but Frances went to her deathbed saying that she had.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this was only admitted in the 1970s, I think.
The other thing to consider was that this was in the north of England. Now, the north of England, Scotland, has quite a rich folklore with fairies. But the fairies themselves in the picture were very much in keeping with the fairies of art of the time. And someone pointed out, one of the skeptics pointed out, the fairies seemed to be, interestingly enough, supporting the latest fashion in clothes and hairstyles, which, I mean, I think feels a bit judgmental, because, you don't know, maybe fairies do follow fashion, we don't know. But it is true that they were wearing Sabba's clothes, and they had bob cuts and stuff like that. It was they were French fairies. So that was the Cottingley fairies.
It's such an enduring thing. These creatures that have gone back thousands of years. And instead of chucking them all out, like the Victorians did with most things, they gave them a makeover.
They did give them a makeover.
And as you say, there was the need for a connection with nature and everything. But it's almost like they went one step further than that. And what they actually needed to do was have nature tamed and under the British boot, like very much of the world was at the time.
Well, yeah, another thing that was pointed out in one of the books that I read was that fairies were extremely popular with men. The common belief is that fairies were for children, but actually fairies, I believe, were catered more toward men. And they weren't very popular with women. And this is actually can very much be reflected in the writing of the era, in that very few women wrote about fairies in the context that men wrote about them. Now, we have two particular versions, examples we can look at. We can look at Christina Rossetti, whose Goblin Market is often believed to refer to fairies. And we can look at Jane Eyre, which uses a lot of fairy imagery. In both of these cases, the fairies that are used in the Goblin Market and in Jane Eyre are closer to fairies from original mythology than they are to the fairies of the Victorian era, even though they were written during this era. And it seems to be that women were not interested in the new fairy, because the new fairy had all of these qualities applied to it, which a lot of these women were trying to get away from. They were diminutive. They were playful. They were secretive in their unavailability. You know, they were seen sometimes fleetingly. They were quite coy.
They were bewinged coquettes.
Basically, exactly. Basically, exactly. That's good. That was exactly it. And so a lot of women were trying to get away from that. So we look at Jane Eyre, and Jane Eyre was compared as a character, she's compared to fairies a lot of the time, but the fairies that she's compared to are not the fairies of the Victorian period. The fairies she's compared to are kind of mean, they're scary.
It's less that they're malicious, they're more sort of very distinctly other. They don't think like humans do.
Yeah, and the other thing is that they're not necessarily beautiful. Jane Eyre as a character, she's not beautiful, she's quite plain, she's odd. That was the thing that marked her out, she was odd, and that's why she's compared to a fairy. Not because of any kind of beauty or diminutive qualities, but because she sticks out, she doesn't belong.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously there's a lot of imagery there, and there's a particular incident where she first meets Mr. Rochester, and she sees the dog galloping down Hay Lane, and it's a big Newfoundland dog, and it makes her think of the fireside tale she was told as a child, and she thinks of the bar guest.
Yeah.
If you've ever read anything about the bar guest, you'll know this is not a nice fairy. The word's supposed to have come from something like Biergeist, which means a ghost that attended the funeral pyre. And one thing in older England, pre-Victorian era, geist, ghost, fairy were all very much the same thing.
Yeah.
There wasn't a big distinction between ghosts and fairies.
Well, they were considered to be, yeah, they were. The connection between the dead and fairies is very strong throughout. So, yeah, they were. Fairies could definitely cover ghosts.
But yes, obviously it's not a bar guest, because when she sees the horse with the rider on the back, she thinks, well, can't possibly be a fairy because there's a human involved. But it's a foreshadowing, because the bar guest tends to lead people astray, and the bar guest also foreshadows death. And if you then go and read the rest of the book, obviously you'll see this is a foreshadowing of this meeting, which is a key point in the book.
Yeah, and which, you know, changes everything and does foretell death in some ways. If we look then at Christina Rossetti, I'm a big fan of Christina Rossetti. She offers a very interesting perspective into the Victorian era from the female point of view. And her poem, The Goblin Market, I always find it quite interesting that if we look at fairies, in the popular Victorian fairies in the Victorian era, they are an expression of the desirable qualities in women. And I think that Christina Rossetti was conscious of that. And when she wrote Goblin Market, she made her goblins the desirable, the undesirable qualities of men in the Victorian era. So they're hairy, they're lewd, they're loud, they're gross, and they're very sexual. And I think it was her kind of fighting back from it. She was fighting back from what women were supposed to be by saying, and this is what men are. And it's very interesting that she did that. And it's very interesting as well how, when it was, the poem was published and when illustrations were done for it and stuff, how they changed it and they tamed down the images that she was using. Now, oddly enough, they didn't tame down what was happening in the poem, which is quite graphic in some places. Yeah. They didn't tame that down. What they chose to tame down was how disgusting the goblins were. So I feel like the guy in charge was like, hold on a second, and decided to go, no, we can't have that. Let's tame this down a little bit. And yet nobody was taming down the weird sexualization of the female fairy at all. And someone made the point was that the fundamental change between the fairies, the pre-Victorian fairies and the post-Victorian fairies, was the pre-Victorian fairies were sexual powers onto themselves. They were there, their sexuality was a weapon against men. So they were sensual beings. I mean, they were sexual. You know, they often, you know, you look at the Lenin she and you look at sort of muses and incubi and stuff like that. They were all fairies. And they used these qualities to lure men, and it was their power. And then the post-Victorian fairies had no sexual power onto themselves. They were not enticing men. Men were the ones who were putting the sexual qualities onto them. They had no control of their own, of themselves at all. They were totally powerless. That is the big fundamental change of where it happened, was the stripping of power. In desexualizing the fairies, they were sexualized in a completely different way. And that has remained. And we look at Tinkerbell from Peter Pan, the cartoon Peter Pan. We look at the way she's dressed. We look at the way that fairies are dressed in art and things like that. And it's different. It's different. And we look at the way they behave and the way that they interact with people, and they're not powerful anymore. They're kind of a nuisance. They're a little bit of a joke when they decide to sort of get a little bit, when Tinkerbell gets annoyed at Peter, she's kind of a little bit, ah ha ha, Tinkerbell, and he kind of locks her in a drawer, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very much sort of, they're there, little woman, don't worry your head about it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it is very interesting that what the Victorians managed to do was pretty much wipe out centuries of, you do not mess with the good folk. They're huge, huge beings of huge power in their own right, and you do not want to interfere with that.
That brings us quite cleanly on to Bridget Clary. Do you know the case of Bridget Clary?
No.
Are you witch? Are you fairy? Are you the wife of Michael Clary? This was a woman who in the late Victorian period was murdered in Ireland. Now, Bridget had been married to Michael for several years, and she was quite an independent woman. She was very smart. She had her own work. They were both earning in the house, so they were actually quite well off for where they were. And one day she caught sick, and some very strange events happened from that point on. And she was essentially tortured by her husband, who decided that he believed she was a changeling, that she had been replaced with a fairy. And in order to get his wife back, he had to force the changeling to reveal herself. And it ended with him, with the help and or under the sort of being watched, witnessed by several other people in the family, burning this poor woman to death, having tortured her basically for several days. And then then hid the body, and all sorts of stuff happened. But they claimed it was because she was a changeling, and that Michael honestly believed that he could go up to a certain hill past that point, and that his wife would be returned to him upon a grey horse. They draw on a lot of mythology for that.
Yeah.
And of course, he was arrested. But he got off with quite a light sentence. And when the British public heard about this, they classed it in the newspaper as the last witch burning in Ireland. And this wasn't true. In fact, as far as witch burnings went, witches were very, very, very rarely burnt in Ireland at all. There were very few witch trials in Ireland. There were a lot in Scotland, there was a great deal in England, but there was not so much in Ireland due to the way that mythology and Christianity mixed together. Witches were not a thing. And Bridget Cleary, was not burned for being a witch. And yet, at this point in time, the Victorians could not associate the fairies that Michael Clary was talking about with the fairies that they had created, because the fairies that Michael Clary was talking about were terrifying, horrible, odd creatures that deserved to be burned, that deserved to be, they were devils, you know, they were demons.
Yeah.
And that's not how they were perceived in Britain anymore. Because people didn't want to perceive them as that. And that shows to me a real difference in that that fairies in Britain were created as an escape. They were for people to escape their monotonous and miserable lives. Whereas the fairies in Ireland and in Scotland and in rural parts of the world, where there was less money, where there was a working class, those fairies were the cause of misfortune. They were the excuse.
They were very much personifications of acts of nature and disease and misfortune, as you say. And they were very, very old. It left a great shadow in the human psyche at the time. And to be honest, that's lingered on even to this day in certain places. Yeah. Certainly it has in Ireland.
I mean, you yourself, you have history there, don't you?
Yes.
Did you ever hear any stories about that, fair folk?
I can tell you one that my gran told me lots of stories. My gran was Irish, and I can tell you lots of stories that she told me. But one in particular I'll tell you, and it's about the Bean She, which has been slurred slightly into Banshee. And most people who've heard of Banshee think of them as sort of female ghostly spirits or fairies that wail, and if you hear them, you die. And it's a little bit more complicated than that. The Bean She originally were tied to the seven great houses of Ireland, and they tended to follow those families, and when a family member was about to die, they would give warning. But as the family sort of died out and bred with the Normans and then the English as they came over, the names got lost. So you had Iconcaver, which became O'Connor, for example, and Inail, which became O'Neill. But those were two of the families that were followed. But the story my gran told me went like this. When she was a little girl, bearing in mind she was part of an Irish Catholic family, so she had 14 brothers and sisters, there was a knocking on the door late one night, and her mother went to open it, and it was the lady from just down the road, who was utterly distraught, asking my great-grandmother if one of her children was out playing a prank, because someone had been knocking on the door for the last few nights, and every time this woman had gone to the door, there'd been nobody there. And of course my great-grandmother said, no, I know exactly where all my children are, none of them have been out. And this happened again and again, and then on the seventh night it happened in the morning. This woman found one of her children dead. And then it happened again, and the following morning she found another one dead. This was a family of 12. By the end of this, everyone in that family, except for the woman herself, had died, including her husband.
Oh my God.
And at night, my gran said that the thing that made it stick in her memory most of all was not just that this distraught woman knocking on the door, pleading for somebody to say, it's one of my children playing a trick. It was the fact that at night, because they were quite close to some of the peat bogs, she said you could hear them. You could hear the Bean She wailing, and it was the most horrible, blood-curdling sound. And she probably told me the story when I was a bit too young, in fact.
Oh my goodness me.
But to her dying day, she always insisted that that was a true story. And certainly the events as they happened, I mean, she would have been 9 or 10, certainly the events as they happened were true, the knocking at the door, or the reported knocking at the door, and everybody in that family dying apart from the mother. And she'd obviously heard something else that associated with it, and apparently several of her brothers and sisters heard it as well. So yeah, that's one of them.
And yeah, so you can understand why that is a vastly different story to the lovely Cottingley fairies who were dancing around the brook and happened to be photographed.
But to put it in context, they weren't well off. Most families had at least six children, if not more. Very few of them had families where all the children survived to adulthood. I know my gran lost, I think it was two brothers and possibly, a sister as well. I certainly don't know all my great-great-uncles and aunts. And disease was rife. Ignorance was also rife. it was very, very different. There were streets where you had the entire street all sharing one toilet, for example.
Yeah.
So perhaps if you had somebody who had, I don't know, if you had an outbreak of typhus, that wouldn't have been very unusual. But they seemed very certain that it wasn't something like that. It wasn't a recognisable disease in this particular story. But you're basing it on the memory of a 10-year-old as well.
Of course, yeah. But of course, that is also how stories get passed on from... Yeah. I remember this when I was a child. So there was definitely fairies as a phenomenon is, I'm going to say it's very well documented. We've got a lot of documentation. We've got a lot of oral tales about fairies and how they're understood and perceived has changed vastly. And that is particularly why I use those separate spellings for them, because there's just no way that you can compare that story that you've just told us, Jules, to the lovely friendly fairies from Sleeping Beauty.
No, or the ones that bless your house and garden.
Yeah, or who dance around with the latest French haircuts and dresses, you know.
Yes, the Victorian propaganda didn't spread that far, really. I think it became more well known, but I think a lot of places, certainly the more rural areas, still held on to their old traditions, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I'm studying. I'm studying how they held on and whether, in particular, the perception changed according to the place. And I think, I'm pretty certain of the results that I'm going to find, but, you know, I've got to do it thoroughly. Even though I'm almost entirely sad.
Well, you might be surprised, you don't know.
I could be surprised, and I could find some other things as well, which I wasn't expecting. But to be sure, the way that fairies were perceived by different classes and by different people in areas just was vastly different across Victorian England, across the Victorian British Isles. And fairies have remained to this day a topic of interest, and they're having another comeback, and they're having another comeback, I think, also because of the popularity in elves, who are a kind of sort yeah. of fairies came sort of from elves in some way. So, you know, we had Tolkien had his comeback recently, and since then fairies have really started to appear again in modern literature and in films. And oddly enough, we're distancing ourselves from the fairies that the Victorians evolve and going back to the nasty fairies that we know from our older heritage. And I wonder whether it isn't something to do with us trying to grasp our heritage again, whether we're trying to do that, except we're not looking for the nice heritage, we're looking for the nasty heritage, because we seem to really enjoy history, sort of terrible histories, don't we? Yes, well, my yeah. ancestors died, don't you know?
Well, I think perhaps the original fairies, if you like, in the same way that, bizarrely enough, werewolves and vampires, the original folklore kind, mm-hmm. not the sparkly kind, they reflected uncomplicated and less desirable characteristics of the human condition, the human mindset itself.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. And maybe that's why the old fairies are now starting to fit in again with the modern setting.
Yeah, I mean, it's very noticeable that it's the old type of fairies, not the Victorian cleaned up versions, that are really making a comeback. I mean, you've got yeah. Holly Black and Marissa Meyer.
Yeah, and we've got A Court of Thorns and Roses.
Yeah.
Sorry, I forget who's written what. That she was Sarah Jane Mass, that was it.
That's right, yeah.
They all have M's. Apparently M is a good initial of some way to have if you're writing about fairies. Yes. So yes, the fairies and her story are the same. They're beautiful and terrible, and they're a little bit different. But the fact that fairies have remained beautiful, that is something. Fairies are still considered to be beautiful, which is something which ties in a lot with the Tuatha De Danann and the Sidhe and the sort of the heroes of fairy folklore and mythology, but isn't necessarily something which is found in the common fairies around and about the place, if that makes sense.
No, I mean, I think it's, as you said, it's become very much an umbrella term, because
yeah.
You would have had the old ones, which would have been like the Tuatha De Danann and the Sidhe, and then you would have had the ones that were considered more mischievous and of a lower form, and would not really the same thing at all, but a bit like the Fëanor in Ireland, where they were part this, part that, sort of a mishmash of things, like they couldn't quite hold their shapes together right.
Yeah.
Cornish pixies, for example.
Yeah.
And knockers. Knockers isn't as bad as it sounds.
Yeah, knockers are from Cornish mythology, and the knockers lived in mines, and they used to, in some versions, they used to warn miners about, they were the ghosts of miners who died, and they would warn other miners about cave-ins and stuff like that, and you would be able to hear them, whereas if you knocked on a wall and you heard knocking back, then you got out of there as quick as possible, because the knockers were telling you.
What was really interesting, as we talked about the Industrial Revolution, and we got to the end of the Victorian era, as we were getting to the stage where we were building aeroplanes, the initial ones, which were horribly, horribly dangerous. A new type of fairy came into being, which they called gremlins. And they're not the cute furry little things that you shouldn't feed after midnight. They were things that used to meddle with the engines of planes and make the planes fall out of the sky, effectively.
Yeah, because it was the gremlins.
looking at the engineering, bearing in mind that they were literally having to make it up as they went along, I'm not surprised. I'm actually surprised they had less accidents than I would have expected. But yeah, even up until the Second World War, and I think possibly even now, there's still the occasional, oh, well, there's gremlins, there's a ghost in the machine kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's, it's more, not, it, it's something that's happening in technology as well. I've got a book called Good and Bad Fairies, and it looks at fairies in the modern setting, and there are fairies who mess with your phone and change your passwords, and there are fairies who keep you up at night with intrusive thoughts and make you remember stuff embarrassing from like 16 years ago.
We've Is that taken... one called anxiety?
Yeah. Exactly. It's all to do with fairies. But it's interesting that basically what's happened is that, oh, we don't really need to worry about, you know, the plague anymore. So we'll get rid of the fairy plague and we'll put the change your phone's password fairy down instead. And it just seems that fairies exist to inconvenience other people, to the point where when they can no longer kill them, they just decide they're going to sort of mess with their heads instead.
Can you imagine that, though? I mean, you've got this huge, sprawling, unseelie court where you have got every kind of species of the less likeable fairy imaginable, and they're perhaps having a meeting with their new king or queen, and what they're saying is, no, we don't want you to drown people and eat their livers anymore. What we want you to do is really, really get in the way of them using the internet.
Wait till they're done. Well, wait till they're at that really important bit in the film that they're watching, and then pull the plug.
Or when they're doing a form online, wait until they get to the point where they've almost finished the form, and then just disconnect the internet.
Disconnect it. They've got a submission to go in. They've got a submission to go in. Electricity out. You get it? And I wonder whether fairies are sort of tended to like to mess around a little bit more at the same time. So I think some of them would be keen on expanding in that way, where they can't, you know, pull the cat's tail. Oh, they can still pull the cat's tail and do all sorts of stuff like that. But now they've got to inconvenience us in another way, because we've got all this technology.
Yeah, it's not just about spoiling ale and souring milk anymore, or turning children in the womb.
What's this? They've got fridges. What the hell is a fridge?
Why does nobody leave their milk and cream out on the doorstep anymore?
I don't understand. These poor fairies. They really had to buckle up. So I feel quite sorry for them. I do.
I mean, we have very much used them as to reflect, perhaps certainly in Victorian England, to reflect our own repressed desires, fears as well. Shall we finish off with a little bit of Shakespeare?
Let's finish off with some Shakespeare.
You can't go too wrong with the bard.
You definitely can't. Now, obviously, we were talking about the Victorian era, and I can justify this because Shakespeare became extremely popular in the Victorian period, and in particular, The Tempest, Beth, and A Midsummer's Night Dream were very popular. Now, I haven't actually seen The Tempest. I know, it's awful. I need to rectify that as soon as possible. But I can speak about Midsummer's Night Dream, and I can speak in particular about Shakespeare. But Madeleine, I hear you say, Shakespeare has no fairies in it. Ha-ha! I beg to differ. Sorry. The pantomime in me came out.
Oh, no, it didn't. Sorry, carry on.
I recently had a paper published called The Witches of Macbeth, Echoes of the Ancient Fairy, and it was published by the British Fantasy Society in their latest non-fiction journal. And you can read the article on my website at www.madeleinevaughan.com if you're interested. And basically, since I studied Macbeth at A-level, I have been certain that the witches are actually fairies. And I have several reasons for this. And whether Shakespeare did this knowingly, or whether Shakespeare was just accumulating different mythos and merging them, considering that fairies and witches were merged in a lot of ways, and considering the way that fairies were changed, I think that the witches are fairies. I have several reasons for thinking this. First of all, their powers. The way that their powers are described, the fact that there's three of them, it's very much in keeping with the Breton Corrigan,
yeah.
And with the Morrigan from Celtic mythology, yeah. In that all of the predictions that the witches have are predictions of death. All of the predictions. They say, you shall be Thane of Cawdor and Thane of the other place. There's just thanes everywhere. But that was based on the fact that the other guy was captured and would soon be executed. It was that he was going to be king was based on the fact that Duncan was going to be killed. All of these predictions that Dunstan would come to. It's not Dunstan Wood. It's the wood would come to the. You know what I'm talking about. I can never remember what the wood is called. The walking trees, the Ents that weren't actually Ents. Would come to the castle was based on the fact that Macbeth was going to die, that he couldn't be killed by any. It was all about death, all of their predictions. There's another reason, a very strong reason, other than their powers, that I believe the witches are fairies, and that's the fact that only once in the entire play are they called witches, and it's one line where they're called the Weird Sisters, but only at one point does one of the witches use the word, and she was quoting a woman who refused to give her some chestnuts. And the woman says, "Arrant thee, witch." Now, I stipulate she was calling her a witch as an insult, not as a term. Because let's give some context for the for the Shakespearean audience. If you thought someone was a witch, you thought that they were in bed with the devil. What's the last thing you're going to want to do to someone you think is in bed with the devil? Annoy them. Oddly enough, the last thing you want to do is piss off a witch, because she will curse you. And that's what they believed they did. They believed that witches cursed people. So I would not want to annoy a witch. If a witch came up to me and said, "Give me this," I would go, and run away. I wouldn't want to give it to her, because that would be aiding and abetting a witch. But I also wouldn't want to insult her. I would just run away and fetch the closest magistrate if I thought I was being, you know, accosted by a witch. Instead, this woman tells her to go away and calls her a witch. Now, I think she was calling her a witch based on her looks and not based on her character, because it would make no sense to call someone a witch in that context. There's another reason, in that in a lot of folklore, fairies cannot lie. It's a thing which is based on the fact, based on the Tuatha De Danann, who were the children of Danu, who was the goddess of truth, so no lying there. They physically couldn't lie. Witches, however, are by definition always lying. They just can't stop themselves lying. And yet the Weird Sisters in Macbeth never lie. They keep certain truths, but they never at any point tell any lies. So a lot of their characteristics are fairies, not witches. And interestingly enough, if we consider them to be fairies, they seem to be closer to the original fairies than any of the fairies in Shakespeare's other other plays.
Yeah.
At all.
I mean, I think there's also the fact that you've got three of them, the fact that they prophesize, and the fact that they speak the truth like that.
Their ties with nature.
Well, I was thinking that the more they're tied with the three fates and the Nornir from Norse mythology as well. In fact, they're called Weird Sisters. Weird is the Nordic word for fate
Yeah,
as well.
and the way it's spelled as well, it's WYRD, not.
Not weird as in you're a bit weird.
Yeah.
But yes, they're certainly the fairies in Midsummer Night's Dream are a lot prettier. They're still mischievous. They're still up to no good. I mean, they're basically having this entire fight over who gets to keep this little dark-skinned boy. That's
He's an Indian, a little Indian boy.
yeah, that's right. And there's the whole making Titania fall in love with Bottom, having transformed his head into an ass's head. Puck's always up to no good.
Yeah, and yet at the same time, we see an element of the female fairy tends to have more power in mythology. Titania doesn't actually have that much power. In the end, she, what's his face, Oberon gets what he wants.
Yeah.
He's really the one pulling all the strings. It was still very much a reflection of male dominance in that. So whilst Shakespeare definitely changed fairies a little bit to suit himself, but not as much as the Victorians did.
I mean, the shift comes again in The Tempest with Ariel, who is actually basically a slave. I won't go into too much detail because we're running out of time now, but in that respect, it's more like the fairies of the Eastern mythology, whereby you have Djinn and Djinni who are sort of trapped in lamps and bottles, etc.
Yeah, fairies and Shakespeare, and the fairies that he didn't realise that he was writing, or did, but changed to appease certain kings.
And all of that would have influenced the Victorian depiction of fairies.
Absolutely.
In fact,
So.
they might very well have taken the cute little female sat on a bluebell figure from Midsummer Night's Dream and then run with it. And
Yeah, especially considering that the fairy art was hugely influenced up and up. Pretty much until 19, until 1840, all fairy paintings were scenes from Shakespeare. So, if you consider that painting in particular will have definitely influenced the perception of what fairies ought to have looked like, and ballet and the fairy perception on fairy definition on stage would have shown what they were supposed to move like, we can instantly understand where they got this image from. So there we go, Shakespeare was rocking the fairy and ended up helping create something quite strange in the Victorian period. So well done, Shakespeare. Influencing us even today.
it's so depressing when you read Shakespeare and you think, because I was look it's Shakespeare week soon and I for the library and I was thinking trying to look up phrases we use every day and there's so many that came from Shakespeare and it's like, oh my God, it's impossible to be original as a writer because he's already done all of it.
He has. Well, I just love the fact that we owe the word elbow to Shakespeare.
Elbow.
Thank you, Shakespeare, for the word elbow.
What did we call it before? The bendy bit. Just
No,
the bendy bit in the arm.
I've hurt my arm. What? The bendy bit? The what? The elbow? What on earth is an elbow?
What did you call it when you smacked your funny bone? Okay, sorry,
So,
tangent.
anyway, you called it the fate of the fairies.
Probably. Oh yeah,
There we go.
the bendy
So,
bit arm fairy.
bendy bit arm fairy. There we are, and who said we
Yeah.
couldn't create anything original? Anyway, guys, thanks for indulging me. This was our episode on fairies. There will be others in future. So just to review what we went over, we looked at Jonathan Strange, Dr. Norrell. Not Dr. Norrell, Mr. Norrell. He's
Mr.
not a doctor. Goodness me. We looked at Christina Rossetti's The Goblin Market. We looked at Jane Eyre.
Yeah, we also looked a little bit at traditional fairies from Scotland, Ireland, and various other places in the British Isles.
Looking at the murder of Bridget Clary, and in comparison, the Cottingley fairies. And also, we had a quick look at Peter Pan and at Shakespeare.
So if we do fairies again in future, I say if, when we do fairies again in future, we'll probably look a little bit more at the older folklore. But thank you for listening. And if you enjoy our podcast, you can subscribe on Podbean or on iTunes.
And we'll see you next week. Ciao.
Thanks. Bye. You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com.
Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.